Welcome to the America Magazine podcast. America Magazine is the national Catholic weekly. Visit us online at www.americamagazine.org.
Hello, and this is Tim Reedy for the America Magazine podcast for the week of December 10th. I'm joined this week by Father Leo O'Donovan. Welcome, Father O'Donovan.
Thanks, Tim.
Father O'Donovan is the president emeritus of Georgetown University and a resident here at America House. We're going to talk this week about an exhibit over at the Metropolitan Museum of Art called The Age of Rembrandt, which Father O'Donovan wrote about in the November 12th issue. Now, can you tell us a little bit about what the occasion for this exhibit was?
I was amazed last year when the Met didn't put on a show about Rembrandt because it was the 400th anniversary of his birth in 1606, and there were huge shows in Amsterdam, naturally, of course, and then in Berlin, among others. But the reason they waited is that they were preparing a two-volume catalog of the complete Dutch collection of the Metropolitan, and also they had lent a good many pictures to other exhibitions. And so this show, which has been installed in 2007, the year after the 400th anniversary of Rembrandt's birth, is both a tribute to Rembrandt and his peers in the 17th century especially. What the Met has put on for the first time ever is a show of their complete Dutch holdings in the 17th and 18th century, but mostly it's 17th century. And it's remarkable both for its scope and for its depth. Most great Dutch painters from that period are shown. A few are missing. There's a favorite painter of mine called Averkamp, who did wonderful winter skating scenes, for example. Good Christmas cards if you're a secularist. And he isn't represented, and there are several famous painters of Dutch church interiors, of which the Met only has two examples in toto. But otherwise, there's a remarkable range and great depth in the three great Dutch 17th century painters, Rembrandt, Frans Hals, and Vermeer.
So that's quite amazing when you think about it. So all 228 paintings are from the Met's collection.
From their own collection, and you can't see them all. If you try to, I would personally go to someone's apartment and pin the ribbon on anybody who would look at each one. When you come to the great, great Rembrandt, probably the prize of the whole collection, but that's always debatable. When you come to Aristotle with a bust of Homer, you think, well, I've scaled a mountain, I can go get a cup of coffee. But there is the gift shops to wander through. And after that, there are 75 more paintings in the three galleries where the collection is normally hung. Generally, there is perhaps 100 paintings. There are perhaps 100 paintings on display, and this time it's all 228. So the show cries out for repeated visits.
Yeah, it sounds like it. Sounds like it would be a little too much on just one visit. And you mentioned that painting, which you consider the sort of the prize exhibit. We reprint this in the issue of America, the November 12th issue. You also have a couple others here. We have reprint a couple others here, including a self-portrait, which most people would be familiar with. I mean, this is a classic picture by Rembrandt.
Yes, it's a great favorite of mine and a treasure of the museum. There are, by the way, other. I think most people know that he did countless self-portraits, and there is a great, great self-portrait at the Frick. If you want to do a short Rembrandt tour, you can go to the Frick and avoid the crowds. But in this wonderful late painting, when he was bankrupt and beset by all sorts of complaints, he could show himself in a saddened or annoyed manner, and instead of that he just presents himself once again as a subject of study, as a human being, and we realize that he's mapping our souls as well as his own. It was a gift of Benjamin Altman, the founder of the great old New York department store. Altman was a very shy man, a bachelor. He was Jewish, and hence he was not courted, unfortunately, by the trustees of the museum. But he knew what he was doing. He built up an extraordinary collection. And when he died, he left the Met in the early 20th century the finest collection of Dutch art they were ever given, including six Rembrandts. Actually, I have a mistake in the article with which Walter Liedtke pointed out to me. I say there are five. He says there are six.
Six, okay.
He is certainly correct.
You also mentioned here we have a picture of a painting by Vermeer. This is a young woman with a water pitcher. Now, people will probably be most familiar with the girl with the pearl earring. That's also a Vermeer.
That's in the Mauritshuis in the Netherlands. But the Vermeer did many such young women by windows generally, often doing very simple household chores. except that in this case, when you look more closely at the painting, you realize that she's almost certainly not a servant girl. She might look like a servant to a contemporary American, but if you look at the beautiful white cover over her shoulders, that's a mourning veil to protect her as she does mourning ablutions and greets the day. And the white veil over her head is something that a fairly comfortable young woman would wear. The bowl is a symbol of purity. The whole painting represents an ideal young woman in a perfectly managed household. She's bathed in light. The forms are all beautifully balanced. It's a painting that, as I was looking at it for the first time in this show, two very well-dressed young women were looking at it, and one woman said to the other, "I could stand here forever," which I very well understood. This was a gift from Henry Marquand, who was the museum's first president, and he gave in the course of 2 years a very large collection, of which this is probably the finest. His gift also included the first Rembrandt in the Met's collection, but it's in very bad condition. Happily, he also had a couple of fantastic Frans Hals. For people who know Dutch art, the contrast between Rembrandt's very, very apparently careful portraits and Hals's portraits, which often looked as though they were just dashed off, is great fun. And many people in their early care for art, I think, were first taken by Frans Hals. He may be a little bit less in favor now, but the many Frans Hals in this exhibition are worth a visit. In fact, one way to see this show, one way to look at it, is to say, I think I'll go and just look at the Frans Hals that the various donors gave. That would take you a while. If you decide, I'm just going to look at the Vermeers, there are six, which is a very large number for any museum, since Vermeer only painted slightly over 30. You could also do that. I basically recommend that somebody go to the museum for the first time for this exhibition and just wander through, note some of the names of these wonderfully generous people who gave the paintings as bequests almost always, more recently sometimes in honor of one or another curator, and take in what was surely a golden age of painting by any standards, one of the two, possibly, arguably, two great golden ages of painting ever in art history, the other being the same century in Spain.
Now, you just mentioned a couple of the donors and their generous gifts to the museum. That's an interesting focus of the exhibit, and something that you also address in your piece, is gives a little story about the people, the Americans, who purchased these works. That's an unusual take, to look at the people who gave the pictures.
Well, the curator, Walter Liedtke, was faced with this problem. I have 228 paintings. How am I going to organize this? And how am I going to organize it so that I give the various painters their due, but also represent the institution? The exhibition has been criticized by at least one very prominent critic, but it's been criticized for emphasizing the cost of the paintings and the donor's wealth. I, on the contrary, think that we're very lucky to have such a great museum in New York City and to have had such wonderful philanthropy that built these collections and then gave them so generously and often unexpectedly. It wasn't expected that Altman would give all these paintings to the Met. There was another wonderful donor in New Jersey, for example, who made locomotives. He didn't know a great deal about art. He didn't have a big art collection, but he came in every year and gave his annual dues of $10 to the museum's director, and when he died, he left the museum $5 million, which was a huge amount of money. It was unrestricted, and when the museum invested it under J.P. Morgan as the president, they were able to accrue each year $200,000, which made it possible to have a reasonable, carefully thought out acquisitions program.
And some of that was used for the Dutch collection?
Yes, very, very decidedly.
Now, yes, I mean, you have a good quote here near the end from Wilhelm Bode, am I pronouncing that
Bode,
right?
Bode, yes.
Bode, European art historian, who admired the, quote, noble ambition of the American philanthropists. Now, why were American buyers so taken with Dutch art at the time? Because they really, that was their focus.
Well, they collected other things, other painters, English 18th century painting, okay. for example. But the donors of that time also saw in the Netherlands in the 17th century particularly many of the traits that they admired in their own country. The Netherlands had won independence from Spain. It was a culture of commerce. People were not embarrassed to be in commerce. Religion and culture had a certain, well, religion and government had a distinction made between them. The country was largely Protestant, by the way, and the exhibition is notable for a lack of particularly religious paintings. There's one painting I'd like to say something about, if we have time, that is very religious. But if you notice, to my recollection, there's not a single nativity in the collection or in the exhibition, although Rembrandt, for example, did fantastic nativity scenes and beautiful Madonnas and Madonna and Child. So they admired the Republican spirit. They admired the sense of a working world. There was, as in the famous phrase, a Protestant work ethic represented in the Netherlands, which these collectors admired.
Now, you said you wanted to talk about one religious painting of note in the yes. Rembrandt collection.
Yes, I mentioned in the little piece in America, the painter Hendrik Terbruggen. In 1625, which makes it one of the earlier paintings in the exhibition, he did a painting called The Crucifixion with the Virgin and St. John. It was lost for many years and not known very well by art historians, but the Met bought it in 1956, and it has become increasingly admired. It hangs usually in the museum with the Caravaggios, and why would that be? Because this was painted a few years after Caravaggio's death, and the play of light and shadow in it is sensational. Even more striking is the agonized figure of Jesus on the cross, where the blood that falls from his wounds seems to be fairly springing out of the canvas. It's painted from a low vantage point, that is to say, you're looking up as though you were almost prone on the ground at the crucifix with this agonized Christ against a most unusual night sky studded with stars. It's surrealistic, really, in effect. The Virgin to the left of the viewer, to the right of Christ, of course, and St. John, the evangelist, to the viewer's right, are modeled on very ordinary Dutch burghers. And you can see that especially, perhaps, in the John, whose nose is red, probably from crying, or just from being a man who worked outdoors a lot. The painting represents a particular view of the suffering Christ on the cross, which, to my mind, is the greatest example in America, I think, of what you see in the Eisenheim altarpiece of Grunewald. It's also interesting that it was almost certainly painted in Utrecht for a house chapel of a Catholic family. Utrecht was the Catholic center, and the you could not openly practice Catholicism, but it was tolerated privately, and many rich families built chapels in their homes, very likely in the top floor of a high Dutch house. Walter Liedtke has ingeniously done is to install this painting in a kind of chapel-like enclosure that gives you a sense of the room in which it once would have hung. It's very ingeniously and nicely done. When you are entering the very large gallery with the Rembrandt, Aristotle with the bust of Homer, it will be directly ahead of you, and you can think of this as maybe a reward for having made your way through the labyrinth of hundreds and hundreds of gorgeous but long works.
Well, then, that exhibit, The Age of Rembrandt, Dutch Paintings in the Metropolitan Museum of Art, is on view through January 6, 2008. So if you're in the New York area, be sure to check it out. And if you can, go more than once, as we've discussed.
Good, Tim. And folks should know, of course, that the museum is open on Friday and Saturday nights later. And in my experience, the later you go in the day anyway, the less the crowds. The exhibition has been mobbed. It's a huge success.
So Friday or Saturday night might be a good choice. Okay, great. Well, thank you. We have a few minutes left, and we'd like to talk about one other article that Father O'Donovan has written for America. This is appearing in the December 3rd issue, and this is about a friend of yours, a colleague, Frank Oves, who's an editor at retiring now from Continuum Books. Maybe you can tell our listeners a little bit about Frank.
Thanks, Tim. I'd really like to. Frank is a man whom countless American theologians, especially Catholic theologians, admire and have worked with over the years, and we had a party for him here on the night before his retirement at the end of August, because so many of us benefited from his editorial intelligence, his sense of market, his commitment to authors. We know that editors are often unsung, so we had a party, and people came from Boston and Chicago and Florida and Washington and I think almost all five boroughs. I can't remember whether we had anyone from Staten Island. Forgive me, any listeners who are from Staten Island, if I neglect you. And what we were celebrating was, in some ways, I regret to say ourselves, because Frank's approach to editing was highly personal. He collected authors, and then he supported them. And I've noted this down, if I may, but let me just, time permitting, mention some of the authors he helped to publish from the beginning of his career at Seabury in 1973, which eventually transmogrified into Continuum International. At the very beginning, he published Hans Urs von Balthasar, Bernard Herring, Hubert Jadin, Otmar Kael, Johannes Baptist Metz, Karl Rahner, and Edward Skillebeck. That would be enough for the Hall of Fame. And then in mid-career, in the 80s and into the 90s, he published Carol Christ, Larry Cunningham, Christine Downing, Father Joe Fitzmaier, Langdon Gilkey, Bernie McGinn, Rosemary Radford Ruther, Elizabeth Schussler-Fiorenza, Francis Schussler-Fiorenza, and David Tracy. And I shouldn't forget the younger people who came along. I was in the mid-crowd. The younger people, Katie Geneva Cannon, Marty Connell, Margaret Farley, Roger Haight, Janine Hill Fletcher, Brad Hinsey, Jim Keenan, Judith Kapicki, Paul Lakeland, Gaspar Martinez, Vincent Miller, Kevin Seasaltz, and Terry Tilley. It's an extraordinary list.
Yeah, that's a who's who of theology in America and abroad.
And this fall, he had two first-rate books on God, both written by women coming out. One is by Beth Johnson, Quest for the Living God, and the other is by Val Webb, Like Water Through Hands. He was as enthusiastic about those two books as about the first he published.
Great. Well, you can look for that in our December 3rd issue. And we also have some quotes in that article from some of the authors and theologians that Mr. Oves has edited over the years. So check that out. Well, Father O'Donovan, we'd like to thank you for coming by, and hopefully you can come back again soon.
Thanks, Tim.
All right.
Pleasure.
Take care. Thank you again for joining us for this week's edition of the American Magazine Podcast. We want to let you know that once we finished our interview, Father O'Donovan wanted to make note of two minor errors. So he noted that Henry Marquand was the second president of the Met, not the first, and there are five, not six Vermeers of the Met. So we thank you to Father O'Donovan for being so conscientious. Be sure to check out our podcast and subscribe at americamagazine.podbean.com. This is Tim Reedy for America Magazine.